This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You know the setup. There's you, me, top experts, a virtual meeting room, and 28 minutes. This week, the pandemic, how broke is Britain? This week, the Chancellor of the Exchequer told us that the country was in big economic trouble. Unemployment was set to rise to 2.6 million, and borrowing to keep us afloat this year to nearly £400 billion. So how long can we keep on doing this before Britain goes broke? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we need to understand a few things, like what is a debt and what is a deficit, and just how big and bad both actually are. Joining me to advise on the state of things is Jajit Chadha, Director of the National Institute of Economic Research. Jajit Chadha, could you just run me through our current statistics on debt, proportion of public spending to GDP, and tell us what the importance of each is?
The country in every year produces a certain amount of goods and services, and that's defined as its income or its production, and that's called GDP, gross domestic product. And the best way to think about the level of public debt we have, what the government has borrowed, is relative to that measure of output or GDP. And so what we currently have in the middle of this COVID crisis is that debt has gone up relative to GDP and looks to be about the same level as the output in the economy, which broadly speaking means that the government has borrowed as much as the size of the economy itself. In normal times, we would expect that number to be something like 40% of GDP, so less than half the value of the goods and services that we produce in any year. Right now, it's about the same size.
Now, stepping away from the debt question for a moment, what can we say about who, despite what the government's been doing, has been hit the hardest? And what can we say about things like the unemployment rate?
The hotel sector, the recreation and leisure sector in particular, these account for some 10 to 13% of jobs in the economy. So directly, these bits of the economy have been brought to a shuddering halt in March, with some relaxation over the summer, but once again brought to a halt by and large in the autumn this year. And because they comprise a relatively large part of our economy, that has been one of the main reasons the economy has contracted so much. Where unemployment might go in the future very much depends upon how we deal with the virus and the ability to adopt a vaccine that is effective and roll that out across the country. If we can do that well, unemployment may fall back to the 2 or 3% that we have seen in the last decade or so. But if we don't, I'm afraid it could rise even further.
Now, one thing I've been struck by in the last day or so is what people have been reluctant to talk about is the impact of Brexit, whether it's a skinny deal or a no deal, on our prospects for growth next year and going forward.
In the medium term, Brexit doesn't obviously help the economy. We have a particular trade structure with Europe, a particular domestic structure of production that is related very closely and tied to our relationship with Europe. By breaking that relationship, the likelihood is that in the short run, growth will suffer, as your question suggests, by some 1% to 2% of GDP. What Brexit would also do is likely to hit the bits of the economy that haven't been hit by the COVID crisis. So we talked earlier on about how the COVID crisis is hitting recreational hotels and leisure industries. Actually, Brexit will also tend to impact on, you know, manufacturing, finance and IT, so the bits that haven't been hit. So what you've then got are two separate shocks, almost affecting broadly the whole of the sectors of the economy. And that is likely to be a similar order of magnitude in terms of the long-run impact on the economy as the COVID crisis.
In view of those aspects, What did you make of Rishi Sunak's spending review?
I think the problem with it is we have a one-year framework that doesn't really allow for any long-term planning in the bits of public expenditure that need support. Health, infrastructure, education, the digital economy, all of these are very well established, what we might call capital gaps in the UK that need to be addressed. Yesterday, focus solely on the big numbers that have come out of this year, rather than saying, look, what kind of economic strategy do we need over the next 4 or 5 years?
Jajit Chadha, so that's how things stand. But have we been here before? And if so, what did we do? Nicholas Crafts is Emeritus Professor of Economics and Economic History at the University of Warwick. Nicholas Crafts, how useful do you think it actually is to draw parallels between what's happening now as a result of COVID and what's happened in the past, say, in the aftermath of World War II?
Yeah, I think post-World War II is an interesting period. The debt-to-GDP ratio was much higher than it is today, but actually we succeeded in getting it down quite quickly over a couple of decades, between, say, about the late 40s and the late 60s. And we did so without having a massive fiscal squeeze.
Can you tell us what the debt-to-GDP ratio actually was back then?
The peak just after World War II was 2.5 times GDP. Still at the start of the 1950s, it would have been about twice. And then over the period to 1971, we actually got it below 60% of GDP.
So it's been much higher than it is even now under the pandemic.
Oh, yes. And it was also much higher in the interwar period. In the 1920s, after World War One, we're probably talking of about 1.7 times GDP.
At the most basic level, why did we regard that as a problem in the post-war period? So you've got this high GDP ratio. Why was it felt necessary to get it down? What were the consequences of not getting it down?
I think the standard way that we'd approached economic management over probably a couple of centuries was that we liked to be credit worthy in normal times so that we could borrow like crazy in an emergency. And that was World War II, borrowing like crazy, borrowing much more as a proportion of GDP than we've been doing just recently. But credit worthiness regarded as an appropriate position where you could borrow without people lending to you feeling it was terribly risky. You could do that without pushing the interest rate up against you a lot. So I think it was consensus after World War II that one would want to get the debt to GDP ratio down.
So there you have the governments in the post-war period. They want to get that debt down, and yet they also want to build up the welfare state, famously. So how do they manage that trick?
Yes, I mean, at the end of World War II, Labour wins a landslide in the 1945 election. They more or less adopt the Beveridge Report on how to reform Social Security, the health service, and so on. So they do want to spend more. That actually the ambitions of the Beveridge Report and even the Labour government were in a sense quite modest. At the start of the 1950s, say, we're probably only spending about 3.5% of GDP on health. We're probably only spending about 5% on Social Security. These are very modest sums relative to today, even though they were a step forward from the 1930s. I think the key thing that was in our favour was that interest rates were low relative to the rate of growth that the economy could achieve. And when the growth rate is well above the interest rate, that gives you quite a lot of fiscal leeway. You can actually run modest deficits and still see the debt to GDP ratio decline quite steadily.
Now, of course, we don't have that kind of productivity bonus at the moment, famously. So I'm wondering what you think the takeaways are in positive terms from that period that could be implemented or useful to us now.
I think the takeaway that when the real interest rate is lower than the real growth rate, there's more scope to be fiscally a bit more lenient, is a message that still does carry over. Growth won't be so high as in the 50s, but The thing which they did do after World War II, which I think we would have to face up to, is that also involves keeping some reasonable control of borrowing. And that would mean to finance a bigger welfare state, taxes definitely would have to rise.
Nicholas Crafts with a sobering message from the past to those who like their taxes low. But let's draw the net of example a little wider. Are there things to be learned from the experiences of other countries? Most recently, from that of Japan, which endured an entire decade of economic stagnation. Adam Posen is the president of the Peterson Institute of Economic Affairs and a former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. He's been looking at how the Japanese recovered. Adam Posen, you've recently written about lessons that can be learned from the experience of Japan. Can you remind us what their problem was?
In essence, David, Japan got into bigger trouble than any of the other rich countries had before the other rich countries. So it had a huge stock market boom and bust in the late 80s and crash in the 1990 and 92. And then they had a decade that was lost in the sense that they had a recession and never came back out. They had deflation and they had, by their standards, high unemployment. At the time, or at least by the mid-late 90s, people like me, Paul Krugman, and a few others were saying, this isn't something specifically Japanese. This is basically what Keynes wrote about in the 30s. And if they respond in the way recommended, they'll be okay. And that's, long and the short of it, is essentially what happened. They had an activist prime minister, Junichiro Koizumi, who came in 2001, I think, and his economics minister, Heizo Takanaka, and they turned it around.
From what you're saying, they were initially quite resistant to taking the steps that might be necessary to change that. And then they did. What made them change tack?
Part of it was simply that they had tried the other way and it was getting worse, not better. The other way being like the euro area did in 2010, 11, 12, which is, or like David Cameron did, which is trying to do austerity, trying to not overdo monetary policy and finding that that made things worse, including on the debt, rather than better. When the prime minister had just stepped down, Mr. Abe took office in 2012. He did a new round of leadership and innovative policies. They engaged a lot in coordinated macro policy, by which I mean the government issued a lot of debt and the central bank, in this case the Bank of Japan, accommodated it, meaning they bought enough to keep the interest rates at a steady low level. And that's something that generally has been avoided by a lot of central banks for the last few decades because of the memory of the 1970s. But in the kind of low inflation, low growth world that we're all in right now, that's actually a pretty sensible way to go. The second piece that it's not just expansion, and this is particularly true since 2012, is they haven't really been wasting the money the way they used to, the public money. I mean, it used to be there were all kinds of jokes and stories about how many rivers in Japan had been laid with concrete and how many highways and bridges to nowhere with zero population were there. But they've actually put the money into things more recently that are more useful. Not perfect, but more along the lines of public investment that pays off. In particular, they've put more money into childcare and helping women pursue their careers. And so the number of women working in Japan went up hugely between 2012 and the start of the pandemic. So it's expansionary with central bank and treasury or central bank and finance ministry working together and with some of the spending going to supply, good supply, not just consumption.
So essentially, they borrowed more to spend more, but spent better is what you're saying.
That's a nice way to put it, yes.
What did they regard as the constraints on their capacity to spend more? Or did they decide that these constraints, the usual constraints that we think about, debt to GDP ratio, things like that, when did they decide that that was going to matter less to them and that what they would gain from it would actually help them out even of that situation?
I think they only decided that or came to that view later in the process once they had actually done it. What had happened was there was a whole long period there, including under Koizumi in the early 2000s, where they felt guilty about the amount of spending and worrying about not having enough taxes to cover the debt. And so it was only after the fact that they realized that there wasn't a problem. They had a lot of trouble getting to this point. And they would every few years raise the taxes, particularly the VAT tax equivalent, the consumption tax, and say, okay, we need to do this. And what would happen is every time the economy would go sharply into contraction, the amount of debt that they would pay off would be very limited, or it would get worse because the contraction outweighed the additional revenue. And they didn't get any benefits from it in the direct sense. And so finally, they just sort of threw in the towel. And then there were people, including my colleague Olivier Blanchard, who've since pointed out, well, this actually makes sense, because when interest rates are so low and they're lower than the growth rate of the economy, you can get away with this. Under certain circumstances, the limits on public debt are much less binding than we used to think.
But I suppose that the question then is, looking at Japan, was there actually effectively a limit to how much they could safely borrow?
Well, at least they haven't found it yet. When the markets decide that it's not credible the government will someday be able to pay you back, then is when the money leaves. I mean, this is what happened in Greece. Now, in Japan, there is admittedly less risk of that than there is, say, in the UK, because almost all the debt in Japan is held by domestic investors. And because the tax rate in Japan is low, it's credible that if they had to, they could raise taxes. And that's less true for the UK, say, than for Japan. But these are differences of degree, not of kind.
If you were to try and push the experience of Japan into the current situation facing the UK as we emerge from, hopefully, from the economic impact of COVID-19, let's imagine I'm the Chancellor of the Exchequer and I turn to you for advice. What would you advise me to do?
Well, the UK does have more of a constraint than Japan, but less of a constraint than Greece. So you certainly can do more public investment than you've been doing. And in particular, as everybody keeps saying, there's issues of housing provision in the UK. And so that has to be accompanied by regulatory changes on greenbelt land use, but it should be doable. And you do a massive housing building campaign. There is certainly work to be done in terms of public infrastructure on the power grid. There is work to be done in terms of preparing for electric and autonomous vehicles. There is work to be done in converting cities now, because presumably we're not going to need the same office buildings at the same level of intensity of use that we had pre-COVID. There is certainly much to be done on public investment in non-university skills education, in apprenticeships, in training. These are issues that keep coming up. But for whatever reason, successive UK governments have not taken them up, and I think it could be done. The final thing is you have to then have a relationship with the Bank of England, which remains independent, but get them to agree to keep policy loose until they feel there's an inflation threat, which frankly should not be for a long while.
I imagine also that we can't look at this as if we were somehow cut off from the global community. In other words, there's going to have to be action on a global level. What kind of action do you think the British government should support at a global level to help assist this process?
So one of the things you can do is using the G7, using the G20, using the IMF and the OECD, you can make statements that we're going to not engage in currency or trade wars. We are not going to try to get into bidding competitions over lower taxes. We're just going to support each other in doing public investment. A second thing you can do, which is frankly more at the prime ministerial level than the chancellor level, is you start worrying about a Green New Deal across borders, common standards, common rising carbon prices, common competition and support for new innovations in the green sector, common support for moving people out of the old dirty industries.
Adam Posen. So we have lessons from history and lessons from abroad. Returning to the UK, I want to know more about the possible priorities for bringing debt down long term and encouraging economic growth. Gemma Tetlow is Chief Economist at the Institute for Government, and Abigail Adams-Prassel is Associate Professor of Economics at Oxford University. Gemma Tetlow, the Office for Budget Responsibility has revealed that we have very high debt levels in the UK economy. At what point does that debt level become a real problem?
While the UK government can afford to borrow quite a lot in the short term and investors are willing to loan to the UK at quite a low rate of interest, at some point, if the UK keep borrowing an awful lot year after year and keeps on racking up more and more debt relative to the size of the economy, investors will start to question whether the UK can in fact keep servicing that debt and keep paying it back, and may start to charge higher rates of interest. And that creates a risk for the UK's public finances if investors do suddenly start to charge higher interest. The other risk is that what we've seen during this pandemic is the value of the government being able to step in and throw an awful lot of money at the economy to keep things going and to try and minimise the long-term costs of this pandemic. Now, hopefully this is not a situation that we're going to see happen all that often, but it would be good for the UK government in future to be in a position where it could again step in if the economy really does need its support in a major way.
Abigail, is that broadly the way you see it?
Absolutely. And the point that Gemma made about in the medium term needing to think about different changes to the tax system, I think, is also key. And if we could use this opportunity to reform parts of the tax system, which we've known aren't working particularly well for a while, there could be opportunities here as well. So, for example, equalising taxes on different forms of earnings or taxing capital gains on the same basis of income would help us to create a fairer tax system that could eventually be called on when needed to reduce the debt.
So one of the possibilities that we have for trying to deal with this long-term debt problem is a reform of the tax system, which will effectively raise more revenue, Gemma. What are the other options that we have?
There are really three categories of measures to try and deal with this borrowing problem. One, as you say, is to raise taxes. The second is to cut spending. And the third, which is really the holy grail, would be to find some way of boosting economic growth such that we can grow much more quickly. And that will help us to fill the hole in the public finances. We really are going to have to look to tax rises to help fill the current borrowing problem. To cut anything out of public spending, you're really talking about reining in spending on public services. And we did that very significantly after the financial crisis. But what we've seen over the last few years is that it's become harder and harder to try and take any more money out of public services. And indeed, really, since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister, he has made significant pledges not to return to austerity for public services and has some quite significant commitments to, if anything, increase the offer on public services. So it's not obvious that this government is in a position where it would be able to take more out of public services. The other area of public spending is the welfare social security budget. Some of that goes to people of working age, just under half. That was actually squeezed quite tightly as well after the financial crisis. The other bit of the welfare budget is what goes to pensions. That wasn't squeezed at all after the financial crisis, but nor have we seen much indication from this government that they plan to cut pensioner benefits. In the third category, the holy grail of ways to boost economic growth. If there were easy answers there, then previous governments would have taken them.
Abigail, let's think about difficult answers there then. In very broad terms, what kind of measures could we take to improve productivity and, if you like, kind of shift the basis of some of the economy?
So I think there's the reform to the tax system. So a lot of the growth in employment that we've seen since the financial crisis has been in solo self-employment and insecure work, for which there are very few incentives for firms and workers to actually invest in training and invest in a productive relationship. I think another thing we need to think about is women and the caregiving infrastructure have not featured at all in any of the speeches that the Chancellor has given since the start of the pandemic. One thing that we've seen is that if you look at changes in employment of women over the crisis, the largest fall has been amongst part-time women, who disproportionately are those who face caregiving responsibilities. I think that what the pandemic has shown is that if we're expecting working parents to work and invest in their careers, we need a caregiving and childcare infrastructure that supports this.
So these might be key ways of boosting productivity. I was also wondering, Gemma, whether there are also significant changes in the way we're going to be working that we could conceivably take advantage of. I mean, one of the big industries that's going to be boosted as a result of the pandemic, for instance, is biotech, which we already have a degree of interest in.
I think one of the big unknowns still about the pandemic is the extent to which some of the ways in which our lives have changed are going to persist after we're no longer at risk from the disease, including things like the ability to work from home more often and the less of a need to all be concentrated, particularly in the centre of London. That may create economic opportunities for parts of the country outside the traditionally vibrant city centres where most office workers have previously been located. There are obviously other opportunities on the horizon in terms of new technologies, including because of the government's desire to get to net zero carbon emissions, which necessitates putting money in developing new green technologies. That is one area there is potential.
Abigail, should I look at where we are and think, oh God, it's going to be really, really, really bad and there's not really much of a way out of it? Or should I think, well, it might be difficult, but there are real opportunities there for us?
I think that the objective needs to definitely be the latter. There are opportunities here that can be exploited. However, not doing anything and not making hard choices now is going to have real costs down the line. So if we just think, for example, about the fact that young people in the economy have been hit hardest in this recession so far. So there are now 2.74 million young people who are inactive. This is the group who are most likely to have been made redundant. And we know that being unemployed while young has long-lasting effects. So whilst targeted support now is expensive, doing nothing could cost even more. And what we need to do is think about how do we support young people at the start of their careers now to move into this kind of potential rebalancing that's going to be going on in the economy, given the fact that spatially economic activity might not be so concentrated in London, and also the patterns of demand in the economy may change if we move away from a reliance on a kind of office-led model of where and how individuals work, which at the moment supports this kind of low-skill economy in terms of cleaners, in terms of cafes and restaurants. We should be using this to think about how do we reskill young people, how do we provide opportunities for individuals to move into these potentially more productive opportunities with longer term career prospects.
Would that be your priority as well, Gemma?
Yes, absolutely. Exactly as Abby said, probably the most worrying thing about this pandemic has been what it's done to the job opportunities and prospects of the youngest workers. In previous recessions, we've probably made the mistake of not doing enough to support that group and then ending up with long-term scarring in the labour market as people struggle to get on the first rung of the ladder and then that stays with them for the rest of their lives. So using this opportunity and focusing resources on helping that group to get some work experience, to build up their skills and match them with appropriate jobs, I think is very important.
Gemma Tetlow there with Abigail Adams-Prussell. And my conclusion is, no, you can't borrow like this forever, and we need to start looking at the longer term, well beyond the vaccine rollout and the end of the pandemic. My thanks to Judy Chada, Nicholas Crafts, Adam Posen, Gemma Tetlow and Abigail Adams-Prussell. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Sally Abrahams, Kirsty Knight and Serena Tarling. The programme was mixed by Graham Puddyfoot and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Next week, we'll be doing an hour-long special on the Brexit deal. We'd like to invite you to send in your questions about how life may change for you after 2021. Send them to thebriefingroom@bbc.co.uk and don't be shy. We may all learn something.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.